This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women with remarkable stories to tell if we only take the time to listen. And that's what we do each week as we honor veterans for their service and sacrifice. We try to preserve their stories so we won't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, how much do we learn? We are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And there are few things as inspiring, as unifying, as patriotic, as satisfying as the phenomenon known as honor flight. We're going to get a taste of that today. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, I'm guessing you're familiar, but here's a quick overview. The National World War II Memorial was not completed until 2004, funded by nearly $200 million in private donations, mostly from World War II veterans themselves. That was 60 years after the war, and most of the 16 million Americans who served in World War II had already left us. Of those who remained, many were not in the position or the condition to travel and visit the monument. And one man's idea to fly a veteran friend of his to Washington has mushroomed into a nationwide effort to take World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial. You'll find local nonprofits dedicated to this cause all over the country as part of the Honor Flight Network, and no matter what station you're listening on today, there is an Honor Flight affiliate near you. This past week, I had the privilege of sending off and welcoming home 63 World War II vets who took that sentimental journey, and I thought I'd share a little taste of that with you. A P-51 Mustang did a high-speed flyby and then came around and landed for the vets to get a close-up view at the send-off ceremony from the historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California, where another World War II plane, a C-54 piloted by Sam Knobb, timed up its flyover with God Bless America.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above.
That was the beautiful voice of Michelle Allison leading the way. The veterans headed to Washington, D.C., where they saw the memorial built in their honor, as well as the other major monuments. They witnessed the changing of the guard at Arlington National Cemetery. And when they landed back in California a couple days after they left, six high school cheer squads, the Atwater High School Band, and a spirited crowd welcomed them home.
Let them hear it, Central Valley. These are the folks who put their lives on the line for us. Welcome home, veterans.
They kept that spirit coming until the final veteran had been wheeled down off the plane and through all that red, white, and blue. I've got a few photos of that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page if you'd like to take a look. And we're going to hear the story of one of those 63 veterans today on Hometown Heroes. He had a few poignant words to share after returning to that powerful and patriotic reception.
I was kind of getting worried about our country, but the way it ended up back there with a school kid and the way it was right here, I feel like we're not lost.
That is 92-year-old Jim Morris, who served in the Army Air Corps during World War II. You'll hear more of his summation of honor flight a little later in the show. I first met Jim about 5 years ago, but most of you listening now never heard that conversation. At that point, Hometown Heroes was on only one station as opposed to all the affiliates who air the program these days. And I was talking to him then because Jim's face was about to grace a mural in his hometown of Exeter, California, along with other Exeter natives who served on B-17 flying fortresses during World War II. I started out by asking about December 7th, 1941, and if he remembered how he found out about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Absolutely. I was in Los Angeles at the rodeo grounds in East Los Angeles, and I was down there because I went to Cal Poly, and we were down there showing cattle and stuff. And the rodeo was in the last afternoon, and they didn't say anything about the Pearl Harbor or anything until the rodeo was over. And then at 4 o'clock, they started in with newspaper hawkers, you know, coming through, holding it up, and everybody was just dumbfounded, and I was. And it took us hours and hours to get back to San Luis Obispo that night, I'll tell you. It was just a mess.
So many cars on the road?
I saw a few, and every 10 miles, the highway patrol stopped us going up 101 and checked us, and we were in a 35 Ford with a coupe with a convertible, with a rumble seat. And two of us was in the rumble seat, and so we had to get out every time and so they could check us out and look in there and see what was there, if anything.
You know, I think a lot of people forget about that, especially if they were somewhere further away from the coast. But they're so close to the coast, they're looking for Japanese and Japanese Americans.
That's right. So they stopped it. I mean, it was a stop on the highway 101, and of course that goes right along the coast. And they were afraid they were subsided off the coast, they said, and so consequently they weren't taking any chances.
And I also find it interesting that the rodeo was more important. They had to make sure nobody left the rodeo before it was over, huh?
Evidently that's what it was, but I guess they didn't want to scatter everybody because the minute, you know, that if they'd have said it at 1 o'clock or something, well, it would have been a big mess, and it was a big mess anyway, but at least everything was over.
Well, but I imagine there had to be all kinds of thoughts running through your head as a 19-year-old boy every time you get out of the car and you're saying, this is a different world I'm living in all of a sudden.
All of a sudden, you're a suspect, I guess, without being one, but they want to make sure.
So you were a student at Cal Poly at the time. Did you think, you know what, I'm probably going to have to get in this war at some point?
Well, yeah, I didn't even think about it that day, but in a few days or time we thought about it a little bit, why I joined the Air Force and Army Air Corps at that time. And consequently, they didn't take you right away, although they said, I want you, you know. But so I left after that semester, and I went in then in the spring or early summer.
So you knew right away that you wanted to take this into your own hands and join yourself instead of waiting for them to draft you?
Well, because I just felt like if I was going to have to do something, I'd rather do it on, you know, volunteer and ready to go. And I wanted to be in the Air Force rather than the infantry or sailors or something else, you know.
Now, I asked, every time I interview someone who served in the Army Air Corps, I ask this question, I think, because so many have told me whether they ended up as gunners or navigators or radio men, that the reason they chose the Air Corps is they wanted to be pilots. What about you? Were you thinking maybe you would be flying a plane?
Well, I joined with the idea of whatever they wanted me to do, but I had in my mind, yeah, that I wanted to be a flyer, but they said we need gunners and we need armor gunners, which take care of the bombs and stuff on a B-17 or whatever I was on. So that's where I went, and I was happy to do it. I mean, I didn't care which way I went. They were filled up at the time with air cadets, and so I say everybody was joining or being drafted or, you know, taken in. So consequently, they needed gunners more than they needed right then. They needed pilots. Like, not that they didn't need pilots, but what I'm saying is they had so many different varieties to do that's where they sent you. So that's what I did.
And I'm curious now, I'm talking to you here on your property outside of Exeter, the same area where you were born, and you just came in from feeding all your horses. And I'm curious if growing up in a ranch setting where you had to get out there and feed horses or do all the dirty work, did you feel like that toughened you up a little bit and prepared you for what you were going to face in the service?
Well, I didn't know what the service was going to be like, but I knew that, you know, raised on a ranch, you were always busy and you were always doing things. So I figured, well, it wasn't any worse than that, you know, other than going to war. But then the war was had to be fought. So that was the idea of joining and going.
Was it worse when you hit that basic training, when they made you hike forever or do this or do that? Was it worse than being on the ranch?
No, it was easier because they sent me to Miami Beach, Florida, and I stayed in the Fountain Blue Hotel and marched on the beach.
I guess that is a little different than Exeter. So when they tell you you're going to be a gunner, tell us some of the kinds of things that they had you do to develop this skill. I mean, it's not like you're standing still and shooting at a target that's stationary if you're an aerial gunner.
No, you start out with ground instruction and learn the guns, the 50 caliber machine guns and so on. And then then you go to flying gunnery training, and that was in Fort Myers, Florida, and in AT-6s, I think it was, and out over the Gulf, and you shot at targets and so on and so forth like that, and honed your skills the way they told you to fire and do. And so it was a combination of the two, and you could be a, you had to have two on heavy bombers, you had to have two you know, things to do. One of them, there was either engineer who was supposed to know how to handle engines, and there was armor gunners who took care of the bombs, which I was, and there was radio gunners.
Well, you know, you talk about the different gunner positions, and I interviewed a guy before who was a radio man and gunner, and he says that when they asked for volunteers for gunnery school, that they actually told them the average lifespan of a gunner in the war was something like 30 seconds or something like that, because that was the actual combat time in the air. Did you ever hear any crazy number like that that really raised your eyebrows?
No, I never did. It was just the fact that you were supposed to do your job, and if it took till the end of the war or whatever, that was it, you know. And so they didn't specify you might not make it. That was your own assumption that you might not make it, you know.
I imagine that probably wasn't a difficult assumption to make once you saw the newsreels and read the newspapers.
Well, that's right. But when you was there doing it, you knew what they were talking about when they were talking about short time. But, you know, there was a lot of losses. There was a lot of people made it through, and I happened to be one of them.
Well, and I'm glad you did. I'm glad we're sitting here talking today. Now, eventually, after all this training, you get assigned to a crew and a squadron, a group. Tell me about that, and was it exciting for you at the time to know that, no, it's finally going to happen, this is what we're doing?
Well, it did, and we were assigned into a crew, and we joined, it was in Grand Island, Nebraska. And we were all set, got up planes and everything, and got the brief to go to England. At 11:30 at night, we were unbriefed and sent to the barracks. 5 o'clock in the morning, the people that haul airplanes or fly airplanes around took them all, and we went to Newport News, Virginia, and went on a boat to Africa. So it's either one of two things. It was either changing plans real quick, or one hand didn't know what the other hand was doing. I don't know which.
Do you think one is more likely than the other?
Yeah, probably. Probably, and the latter was probably the one.
Well, you definitely know where you ended up, and you ended up on the way to Africa. Now, growing up on a ranch in Exeter, I imagine you hadn't spent too much time on the open sea, so that was probably a new adventure for you, too.
Yeah, very much so, and I wasn't fond of it. I wasn't fond of it before I was assigned to that thing, but I didn't want to be a sailor, so I knew that. So the 30 days I spent in a convoy going to Africa, that was all the sailor part I needed, and I didn't have anything to do but stand guard at night, and I don't know what guard from, because who was going to get on a plane or on a boat in the middle of the Atlantic, you know? But anyway, you had to pull guard, of course, and so on and so forth. But it was interesting. I used to sit on the bow of the boat, and there was an old Liberty boat, and it wasn't very big, so I'd sit and watch the flying fishes and watch the porpoises and stuff in different areas and so on. And then when we got to Casablanca, in the Bay of Casablanca, there was hundreds and hundreds of hammerhead sharks all around the boats and stuff. I guess they fed with stuff through people threw over. I don't know.
So you didn't sit too close to the edge when you saw those hammerheads, huh?
No, I didn't do that. That was my first experience seeing a shark anyway.
Now, this was still, I'll let you give me the date when this was all happening, but this is still fairly early in the war, and I imagine there was still a significant U-boat threat at that time.
There was lots of activity with U-boats on our convoy going over, and we had destroyers with us, and I don't know who all fires the boat, but there was a lot of depth charges went off at night, and we saw one time right down through the center of the convoy, which was, there was about 150 ships in this convoy of all kinds, and there was a U-boat went right down the middle, and so they couldn't drop anything on it there, and they couldn't fire really without, because we were too close, so they were trying to save themselves, I think, but as soon as they got out the back end of the deal, of destroyers were dropping all kinds of stuff, and they really hammered on those. I mean, the sound really hammered on those old Liberty ships, I'll tell you. It sounded like it was hitting them, but it wasn't. It was just water.
So I guess that was kind of the first thing that told you, wow, this is what war is like. This is for real. This isn't a Boy Scout game.
There was a whole lot of us on the boat, and there was a lot of them, and there were a lot of supply ships. And so, consequently, the protection was needed real strongly, and of course, they did that. But the U-boats were very active at that time in the Atlantic. And later on, we bombed Marseille, France, which was a huge, not the town, but the U-boat. Germans had a U-boat docking deal there, and it was all underwater with steel plates on top and stuff and like that. But we bombed it several times later on.
You guys did a lot of bombing, and we're going to talk about the intensity of especially 1 month with 24 missions in 28 days, if you can believe that. Right now, we need to take our first commercial break. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to check out photos and even a little video from that welcome home that Jim received from his honor flight. When we come back, we're going to explore some of the 52 missions Jim Morris took part in during World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll hear about 92-year-old Jim Morris's honor flight experience in a bit, and we'll hear from his daughter as well. But for now, let's hear more about this B-17 waist gunner's adventures in World War II, including the way he was introduced to what may be one of your favorite movies.
Well, we arrived in Casablanca and was assigned to staging area. Of course, we were far enough north out of the African war zone that they could show outdoor movies. So we saw the movie Casablanca there on one evening. And the next day, I saw Humphrey Bogart. He was there in North Africa on a USO trip. And consequently, it was I'd never heard of the movie Casablanca before that. But anyway, it always was remarkable to me that I happened to see it in Casablanca before it was released in the United States.
Yeah, I doubt too many people can make that claim. And so then Humphrey Bogart was there with a USO show. Was he someone that you knew about before and had seen other films with him, or you just saw him the night before in that film?
I knew who he was and everything, and I was surprised. I didn't know about that movie because it was just released, but I had known some other things that he was in. I don't know exactly what, but I did know who he was. But anyway, he was he circulated around among us all the next afternoon and so on. And his wife was with him, and there was some singers and a couple of dancers and so on and so forth. But he didn't just stand on a stage. He walked around among us and talked to us, you know. So I got to meet him, and it was kind of a surprise, I guess, or something.
So every time someone talks about that movie, you say, well, I think I've got a story.
Well, yeah, every time we talk about the movie, I always have to say, well, I saw it in Casablanca, you know. Oh, yeah, I know you did.
Well, I guess the question is, have you seen it? And, of course, the famous line in that movie is, play it again, Sam. So have you seen it again, Jim, since then?
Yes, I have. I've watched it several times on replayed on television, and I've seen it actually it was still playing in the United States when I got back, so I saw it there, too.
Not too many people can make that claim, but you did more than just watch movies. while you were there in North Africa. Tell me about your first mission, what you remember about getting in the air in a B-17 and actually carrying out orders for the first time.
Well, it wasn't a real long mission. It was in northern Italy, I think Verona, sub-pens at Verona, Italy, and it was up very close to the upper end of the Adriatic Sea. We bombed the sub-pens there, and it was a short mission, probably 5 hours, 6 hours, something like that. And I thought, well, this wasn't too bad, you know. But, of course, that wasn't all the thing to it. It worked into more things than that, you know, more distance, some more flak, more fighters and everything else. But that was the first one, and it just indoctrinated us into what to expect.
And the guys that you served with, I'm fascinated by the stories I hear from bomber crews, because they seem to develop such a tight-knit relationship and really trust each other. And I guess you really had to. But had you known the guys? Had you been with that crew for a while before you took to the skies?
We had been together through a couple of training deals in Pyote, Texas, and in Dalhart, Texas, and also in Grand Island. After we were assembled, then we flew together, and we started bonding, and it was boys from New Jersey and Milwaukee, and my pilot was a fellow named Wagner, and he looked like Gregory Peck, only he wasn't near as tall. But anyway, he was from Chicago, and he had been as a grown-up boy up there, he had drove taxis, cabs around the city and so on. He was from Blue Island, Illinois. Anyway, and by the way, he ended up ahead of several years later, and not too long ago, he passed away. He was head of the Illinois National Guard Air Force as a general. But the other part of the time, when he first was discharged, he went back home and started a vending machine route, you know, and him and a partner, and they were going to, you know, develop into something like that. But the mob just... Actually, they were mobs, and they broke up his machines and everything else. So he went back in the Air Force, and then later he transferred to the National Guard in Illinois, and that's how come he was the head general of it.
I get it, and we're not surprised to hear the mob reference when you told us where he was from. And it's neat that you kept in touch for all that time. Now, so that you told us about your first mission, give us a sense, if you can, for what your duties were on any given mission. Are you just always at the ready looking for fighter planes that are coming after you? Because there's not much you can do about the flak coming from below, but you can do something about the fighter planes.
Well, you were, of course, there were several hours each time, most of the time, of you were doing nothing because you weren't over enemy you're over enemy territory, but not over targets. So consequently, you didn't very seldom run into fighters and so on. You get a little anti-aircraft fire along in some areas when you're flying into southern Germany or someplace or Yugoslavia or some like that. But so you weren't really doing anything except sitting there worrying about where in the hell you were going, you know. But you had two jobs, and if anything happened to anybody's gun, I was supposed to be able to correct it, or the turrets, or, you know, and the turrets, like the upper turret or the lower turret, or and they both had, the engineer was on the upper one behind the pilot and so on, and we had waist guns in each side of the waist, which we were the armorers, and we worked at, and then, of course, we loaded bombs in Africa because we didn't have enough people to do everything, so we did our own work and cleaned guns and did stuff like that when we were on the ground.
And this is a B-17 Flying Fortress we're talking about. So when you weren't running around fixing this gun or that gun or checking this or that, where were you on the airplane? Where was your typical station?
In the center, or not center, but the metal fuselage. And you had the first one, the E's and the F's, had open windows. When you open them up and put the gun out, later on they were spiderwebbed into a window itself, and you didn't have to open them up. But in those first ones back in Africa and so on, I mean, the B-17E's and the B-17F's, which were before the G's, which the G's had all the turrets, and they also had enclosed windows and stuff. So you, the minute somebody said fighters, you opened the window, got your gun out, and started going and started looking. And everybody was looking. But usually somebody from the tail gunner to top turret gunner, or somebody spotted an airplane maybe 1,000 yards away or farther than that, or we'd watch them come off the ground. And usually you could count at the height we were flying from, say, 21 to 25 or 6,000 feet. You could count 1 to 10, and there was a fighter up there in your area. It didn't take them that any longer than that to get up there when they realized we were coming over.
And when you fly 52 missions, including 24 in a stretch of 28 days, I imagine there's some times that that B-17 you're riding in gets hit, and that you think, well, maybe I'm not going to make it back from this mission. Do you remember the first time that something like that just kind of really took your breath away?
Well, yeah, it was because I counted 26 holes right around my window, and they were from shrapnel from anti-aircraft. But we were wearing flat jackets and stuff, and I had a couple of little nicks in that way, but how this got around my window without coming all the way through to me, I don't know. But somebody was sitting on my shoulder, I guess. I don't know.
You came back from the mission and on the ground, went outside the aircraft and examined it and counted 26.
I could see them before we landed, even I could see holes through the deal. And, of course, the people that was doing work with tin, or with metal, they patched the holes up. Mm-hmm. But they do it so it doesn't drag, air drag, so it made it pretty good. But anyway, there was a lot of times there was a lot of holes and a lot of things.
So you'll vouch for the durability of a B-17.
A B-17 was very durable, and it was all electric. It was electric in a sense. It was wires instead of hydraulics. And you could tear off one area of it or shoot holes in it, and it wouldn't stop you. You might have to use a hand deal to roll the bomb bay doors open or the wheels down, but it still would fly and keep going. So it was a lot better, we thought, than a 24, because it was all hydraulic. And you get one hole in some line and you were out of it. Your turrets wouldn't work or anything. So we thought we were the best, but then I don't know. The B-24s were just as they could fly farther and haul more bombs than we could, but we could get back a lot more times than they could too.
With 52 missions, I imagine they can all kind of run together in your mind, especially after all these years. But there's a special reason that mission number 13 sticks out in your mind?
Well, it certainly did. It was, everybody's a little bit superstitious, and everybody said, well, we're number 13. If we make it through that, we'll make it through the war. Well, anyway, we just got off the ground and lost an engine and turned around, went back, landed, and picked up another one. And so we were behind our group or our squadron. So we were trying to catch up with them, and we lost another engine out over the Adriatic. We were on a trip to Greece, on a mission to Greece. And so we tried to keep up with them, but finally we had to turn around because we couldn't even get close. Well, we had a few fighters pick us up, so we hit the deck down pretty close to the water and made it back with three engines, and a B-17 would do that and may even fly with two, but it wasn't real handy to do, you know.
You didn't want to be flying with two.
We had to make another trip to make our 13th because we didn't cross the line to get, if we had gotten to where we could have bombed anything, we would have been a mission. But just the way it turned out, we didn't catch up with the group. We didn't catch up with our squadron. So we went back and we had to fly 13 again.
You had to fly your 13th mission twice. And you mentioned how the fighters picked you up, which gave you a sense of security flying that low where the anti-aircraft fire would get you. And you know, maybe doing that, you think back to what the Doolittle Raiders felt like, flying that whole thing that low going into Tokyo. And in fact, Jimmy Doolittle ended up as the commander of the 15th Air Force, for which you're a part. Did you ever see him or run into him at all?
At a briefing, and I was one of many because it was all his wings and the squadrons and stuff. And he was very visible, and he was quite a notable guy for the rest of us to know. And or to hear about and so on, and then he was transferred to back, and I don't know, he went back to the States and with a higher command of some sort, but he was very visible when he was over there. I didn't get to meet him exactly, but I saw him, you know. And of course he was busy with the business of the Air Force or the Army Air Corps.
Well, and I never think of it in these terms, but trying to put myself in your shoes at the time, I imagine as young guys in the Air Corps, when you heard the story about what he and all those other Raiders did, and basically a suicide mission, and then he not only escapes, he gets back and he's flying again, and now he's in command of your whole 15th Air Force. That has to kind of motivate you and inspire you a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, he was a very motivating type of a speaker, and when he was addressing us and so on, and so you felt like, well, we're doing the right thing, and you know, let's go, you know, keep at it. And he'd give us a pep talk, and he'd say, look, the 15th Air Force can carry their weight in southern Germany and Austria and Palesti and all of them, he said. So consequently, there won't be a thing you're going to be sorry for when you get through with this, because it's a good Air Force, and you got good airplanes, and you got good ground crews. And by that time, we did have better situation and a few new airplanes and stuff.
So that's a speech that motivates you, but I understand you had other briefings that kind of made you feel like you were a little expendable to good old Uncle Sam. Tell me about that.
Well, in the first part of February, or a number, probably the 2nd of February.
In 1944.
And we were assigned 8 targets in southern Germany and Austria and Palestine oil fields in Romania and stuff. That was very crucial to the supply lines of knocking them out of the German, all of their activities, from trucks, planes, and everything else. There was the ball bearing factories, aircraft factories, the oil fields, and so on. So anyway, that was said that they were we were going to be very expendable, and we didn't know why particularly, because we didn't know the date of, and maybe they didn't for sure, the invasion of Europe. But that was in June, and this was in preparation for that. If you're going to slow down their supply lines, you had to do it ahead of time. So those, and that's why we flew 24 missions in a month of February.
So they were willing to sacrifice the entire 15th Air Force to soften up the continent enough for that invasion.
It had to be done, and I guess it was decided, you know, somebody's got to be expandable and get it done. So we were the ones, the only one that could reach it, because the 8th Air Force couldn't reach them in southern Germany and Austria and down in there. You could go to Berlin, but Berlin wasn't in southern Germany. You know, so we had that part, and we could get to it. So that's why we flew day after day after day after day at those 8 targets. And we did, a fairly good job, because it seemed like we destroyed a lot of the factories and stuff. But they were they could get things going again real quick. We did a lot of marshaling yards, which is what they call their train yards and stuff. And they were all there close to those factories, and we'd hit them as well. And consequently, you'd go back 2 days later, and they had some trains going through there, you know.
Well, and you mentioned how the 8th Air Force couldn't reach those targets because they were up in England. But you weren't exactly close to these targets either. I mean, these are deep penetration missions, right? How long would you say one of those typical missions was?
About 11 and a half hours, you know, and that took every bit of the gasoline and fuel that we had. And he was siphoning the engineer. That was a job that he finally had. He had something to really do later on, was siphon gas from, if you didn't have wing tanks, that tip tanks that would siphon into the other ones, you had to siphon it back and forth across the airplane to keep it, all the engines going. So he was busy, and we lost airplanes because they couldn't get back. I mean, they ditched in the Adriatic or the Mediterranean or wherever.
Yeah, the number of planes that you lost was pretty staggering. I mean, you made it back, and you were one of the minority, right?
I was, it happened to be one of the minority, and like in the four groups in the wing, you know, it'd just be two or three flying out of each one of them, and make the wing up by say 12 airplanes instead of 48, you know. But we were just lucky, I guess. I don't know.
I guess so. More of Jim Morris's World War II memories when we come back, and then the flight he just came back from and the emotions it stirs in him. Don't miss the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, listening to the World War II memories of one of the latest veterans to experience the magic of honor flight and a trip to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. In a moment, we'll hear what he had to say right after landing back home in California. But first, let's go back more than 70 years with B-17 waist gunner Jim Morris. If someone had told you that you were going to fly 24 missions in 28 days and still be alive at the end of that, would you have believed them?
No, I'd figure that somewhere along the line I wouldn't make it, but it kept happening, and we were pretty worn out by the time February was over, I'll tell you. And actually, a couple of the guys gave it up and just couldn't stand it, you know. And one of them was a navigator we had, and he had joined the RAF years before, and then he transferred to the Air Corps to get back. That was the only time I ever saw somebody, you know, completely get unnerved. And they took him off in an ambulance. And it was very shocking to us, the rest of us. We was all tired, but then we wasn't that far quite.
Well, that's the question that occurred to me. What stopped you from breaking up that way? Was there something that you guys did together as a routine or a ritual or anything that kind of kept you focused and kept you ready for that next day and the next mission?
Well, yeah, you discuss it, and you knew that where you were going, where you'd been before, and you knew what it was like, and so you said, well, we're going to work it together and do the best we can.
One thing I think a lot of people don't understand, we're so used to the comforts of air travel today. When you're in a B-17 at 25,000 feet, it's not a pressurized cabin, and it's not exactly heated. What were the conditions like for you?
Well, they were very cold, and of course, in the wintertime, they're colder, and we flew over the Alps a lot, either the Italian Alps or the French Alps or in Switzerland and so on. We didn't go directly to Switzerland, but we flew over the Alps. But anyway, when you're up 25 to 26 or 1,000 feet, it would get down to 35 degrees below zero. And there was just the skin of the airplane. There wasn't any padding or anything to try to keep it that way. And when you open those windows to stick your gun out there, it was just like, boy, it was cold. And it was this first thing it would do is kind of cover up your goggles and stuff, and which you had to wear, all the heated suit, sheep-lined leather jackets and pants and stuff. But I'll tell you what, if that heated suit ever went out, you were just Katy to the wall about getting pretty bitten cold.
I believe it, absolutely. Now, one of the things that you saw on one of your missions during that stretch of 24 and 28 days was what could happen to a B-17 and another guy in a similar position to you. And this is one of those stories that I think really kind of blows your mind, because it's hard to believe. But you saw the tail sheared off one of the B-17s?
Yes, there was a German fighter, I think it was a 109, a Messerschmitt 109, was flying out of the sky down through us, and he got hit. We knocked him down. Well, he went out of control, and he sheared off the tail of a B-17 and about 20 feet of the fuselage. And the tail gunner was locked in there because of his ammunition boxes fell in on him, and so he couldn't get out. So we watched the thing, and you could see it all the way to the ground, and it would take great swoops, it had enough tail surface and vertical stabilizer surface to kind of keep it flying and not, it was going down all the time, but it was, so anyway, as he got down close to the ground, it was very mountainous, and when it got down, we saw the thing, the air currents carry it up the hill, and then it slid down and into a bunch of trees. Well, we didn't ever see him get out, so we figured he either fell out when he first, he got cut off, or else he was still in it and probably got killed. Well, Tito's Patriots, or whatever you want to call them, brought him out to this, the Adriatic Sea, and the Air Sea Rescue, British Air Sea Rescue, picked him up, and he was back in our squadron the next day, or in our group. He wasn't in my squadron.
But the very next day.
The very next day. And then he got a nice trip home right away because he didn't have to fly anymore.
Well, I imagine a few jaws hit the floor when they saw him walking in.
Absolutely. I mean, when we heard, heck, he's back. You know, what do you mean he's back? He's, you know, but it was just a slow, kind of a soaring, kind of like, you know, eagles do or something, and just it was enough tail surface on the horizontal tailplane to keep it going, and instead of tumbling, which I thought it would do, it just swooped. So when it hit the side of that mountain, it would just slid down the mountain. Anyway, he couldn't believe it either. He said, I couldn't believe I got out of the thing alive, you know, because all the way down, he said, I'm it. I'm done, you know.
Well, that's definitely something you have to see to believe, and you saw it. Glad you didn't have to survive anything similar. You did survive the rest of your time in Europe, and as I mentioned, you had enough missions, 52 missions. Before D-Day even happened, you were back in the States. And then they said, well, we'd like you to go to the Pacific and be on a B-29 crew. And you said, no, thanks.
I didn't say no, thanks. There was nothing I could say about it. But I thought to myself, no, I really don't want to. So I said, if I have a choice, I'd like to go to the medium bombers and go down in the 25s because they stay down below the oxygen level. And you could, you know. And so I said, I've got the experience. I can fly turrets in a 25 and so on and so forth. But anyway, I guess they decided that one of the decisions they made that I wouldn't understand is that the war was enough over that they assigned me to training gunnery students in Laredo, Texas, and then back into March Field, and that's where I was when I was discharged.
Well, and I think there's 3 children, 5 grandchildren, and 3 great-grandchildren that are thankful you didn't have to go back to any combat zones because they wouldn't have been here if you didn't come home from the war and get married and have your family. When you look back on all this, and I know it's been a long time, but what do you think was most significant about what you and all the guys that you served with did? Why should it be remembered today, and what should we remember about it?
I think it was the difference between anything after that was the fact that we wanted to win the war. I mean, I don't mean that people didn't in the Vietnam War and so on and so forth, but we didn't seem to, as a nation, fight the war the same way, because there, everybody was gung-ho. I mean, back then, everybody was gung-ho, even though they suffered from it or would be restricted in their thoughts about it. They still worked together to go do it. And the infantry, they took terrible hardships and still kept going. And it was just a real pleasure to me. I mean, interesting to read Ernie Pyle's deal in the Stars and Stripes about the infantry and stuff, because it was an entirely different world than what we were living in. But I never lived in England had barracks and so on, but I lived in a tent from the time I got there until I left. I ate in a tent, and that was it. And we had hardtack a lot of times, but we also got fresh meat, later on. But anyway, it was until the Germans bombed our supply port, and then we didn't have red meat for a while.
It wasn't exactly a life of luxury, but it sounds like I hear you saying that you saw what America was capable of when everybody was moving in the same direction.
It was a great effort, and it was an effort by everybody here in the States and over there. And it was made you real proud that you could be a part of it. I never felt like, I don't know why I had to do this. I never felt that way. Because the thing was, when we got to Africa, there was a lieutenant colonel that was in the Air Force that briefed us on what we were up against, and he said, I'm not leaving here until this war is over. And he said, I expect you to do the same. Well, I would have stayed, but I mean, I finished my missions and they sent me home.
So that was more than 70 years ago. But now in 2015, Jim just finished another kind of mission, an honor flight to Washington, D.C. with 62 other World War II veterans. His daughter Michelle was his guardian on the flight. Here's what Jim had to say right after being greeted by a huge patriotic crowd when I asked him what he drew from that experience with Central Valley Honor Flight.
I got a view of Washington, Washington, D.C., that from still pictures, I never realized what it was really like. But it's so interesting to go the way you go back there and see one thing and it connects up to another and so on. I think the one that we really enjoyed, my daughter and I, was the World War II deal. It's very, and there were so many people there and so many kids from schools, and they were all almost like this deal, you know, because there were several buses of us, of course. It was real interesting, and that one was good. And then the Air Force was the last, Air Force one was the last one we seen. It's not a big thing, and it's not a, you know, elaborate like some of them, but it's really interesting because they got really nice, shiny things with names on them, and then they got these huge things like I don't know what the hell, they look like elephant tusks, only they go up about 100 feet in the air, and they go each way, and I kind of think it's like the Blue Angels, you know, break like that. That's kind of what it looks like. So that one we liked real well. And last night, we didn't get a chance with a group to go to the Vietnam. And so we took a cab and went there, just her and I, and went and walked through. And that's really interesting, very interesting. And then the Korean one is, I've never even seen a picture of it, but it's just outstanding. It's a bunch of soldiers tromping across a field of like grass about that high and water running in there. And then, of course, they're not real, but, you know. And then they got the names and stuff and different things there. But it's all a great experience. And I'm going to say this, whether it sounds like it or not, but I was kind of getting worried about our country, the way it seems to be going to me. But the way it ended up back there with the school kids and all kinds of people, and the way it was right here, I feel like we're not lost. There's more to it than what you just read and hear, you know, because I think you get the negative a lot, and this is not negative, and neither was it back there.
I know you just opened some mail on the flight home.
We did, yeah. They had mail call there. I didn't know how in the world they got any mail, you know. It was letters from here and from school kids in Woodlake and Exeter and all around, and my family and friends that I know, clear even in Oregon and so on and so forth. So it was a surprise to us all there, because we got a surprise for you. You military people were going to have mail call. And so we didn't know all of this stuff had been done ahead of time. But anyway, it was great. It was a surprise. And it showed, again, it shows the sentiment and the pride of the people. And that's, it's not us, it's them.
You took off and landed on a lot of runways like this one while you were in the Army Air Corps.
Yeah.
What did it feel like to step off of this plane and see this crowd waiting for you?
Yeah, we were looking through the window, and it was, they said there was going to be some people welcoming, but look at them. I mean, I couldn't believe this, you know. That's what I said. It buoys my feelings about America. It really does. I just want to say, I want to thank the people that are behind us, volunteer groups that do something like this, because there was other people back there that have gone and from other places, and they just felt the same way. It all fits together with how great America is.
Did it make you feel like what you did mattered a little bit?
Yeah, it sure does. You belong to something that you maybe thought was fading out. And the kids back there, there was kids from on school trips and stuff that were there, and everywhere you run into, they was shook hands and give you letters, and it just made you feel like an American. Again.
Yeah. That's Jim Morris of Exeter, California. And I also asked his daughter, Michelle Leclerc, what it was like for her to share this honor flight experience with her dad.
It really was amazing because we hadn't traveled together in years either. And then to kind of get his take on the, you know, different memorials, and then to see the people coming up to him, the little kids coming up to him, it was really amazing. And I have never been to Washington myself, so I was seeing it all for the first time. He was seeing it for the first time, so it was great to share that memory with him.
I have a feeling you probably looked at him as a hero for a while, but did this give you a new appreciation or understanding of what he did and how significant it was?
Well, he's been one that has shared his stories over the years, but it's just kind of different when you really do stand there and you're standing with all these other, you know, veterans, and you're kind of hearing their stories, and just the feeling behind it, it just kind of put a whole different emphasis on it.
Is there one moment that stands out for you over the last few days that's going to be the one that sticks with you?
Well, I think when we first got to the World War II Memorial and the bagpipes were playing, and then these little kids were coming up, and there was a little girl that gave them this letter, and you know, we took pictures with her, and I read it, and it was just a sweet letter, and he was kind of really surprised by all of that. I think, you know, he was going to see the memorials and all that. But then all the people that came up and shook his hand, and young high school boys and stuff, they, you know, came and talked to him. And then there was a young girl from China, and she spoke to him for the longest time, and she said, China loves you. China loves you. Please, please know that. And she was just here studying abroad. It was some things like that that I think were just, I don't know, so unexpected and so memorable and amazing.
That's Michelle Leclerc, who wouldn't be here if her dad, Jim Morris, didn't survive 52 B-17 missions during World War II. What memories they will share. Just a little snapshot of the power of honor flight. And maybe it motivates you a little bit. I hope you'll get involved wherever you're listening today and make sure that the veterans in your life know about this chance at a free trip to see their memorial. You can find out more at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Effler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.